Kathy. Welcome to Exploring Brown versus Board of Education, Pioneering Equality, the episode where we dive deep into one of the most significant Supreme Court cases in American history. I am your host, Francesca Thompson, and in today's episode, we will unpack the landmark case of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, with attorney Jessica Baker. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show, Jessica.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be back.
Yes.
And I don't want to toot my own horn, but I definitely think you guys should listen to the My Favorite Teacher episode that I did in season one. It's really great.
Yes, that was season one. We had you last. So yep. We're going to have a very serious conversation. And so this is something that me and you have talked about several times. So we, in honor of Black History Month, let's just dive right on into this.
Yes.
So to understand the significance of Brown versus Board, we must first journey back to the early 1950s, a time marked by racial segregation across the United States. The case itself began with a simple desire for equal educational opportunities. That's the start. So what is your take on education during the 50s that led to the Brown versus Board of Education? What were the conditions of the school?
Well, the conditions of the school were really dependent on your state. You know, in the South, there were generally schools for white students versus school for Black students were generally unequal. Sometimes there weren't even schools for Black students. Mm-hmm. The Brown v. Board of Education case is actually several cases that challenged segregation in schools. Brown was just the first named in the complaint. And in his district, so his daughter, Oliver Brown, his daughter attended an all-Black school, Monroe Elementary. Mm-hmm. And the Browns actually loved that school. You know, Linda's mother had attended. She, you know, spoke very highly of her school and her time there. She thought the teachers were great. She said the teachers were very invested in them. And she said that, you know, she thought that Monroe Elementary was actually giving their all-Black students a quality education. Their primary issue with that school was that it was farther away. Like, to get to that school, Linda had to cross like a main street. It was like 21 blocks away, whereas the all-white school was near to her home. So that was one of the cases in Brown. Another case in Brown, in Prince Edward County, you know, you could really see the difference in the quality of the all-white school and the all-Black school there. You know, the Black students said they sometimes had to have classes on school buses. The district would build them shacks to hold some of their classes because the school was just so overcrowded. Meanwhile, the all-white school had plenty of classrooms. They had a gym. And so it was just a much better quality facility than what the Black students were given. So it was really dependent upon where you were living, you know, what type of resources and what type of facility that you had for your school.
So do you think that most people know that history about the Brown family and them actually enjoying their school that they were originally attending?
I actually don't think, because I didn't really know until I read the case. And you know, one of the stipulations in the actual Brown v. Board of Education decision is they go in a footnote, they go through each school and they say, you know, we're considering the all-white school in Topeka, Kansas as being the similar or same as the all-Black school in Topeka, Kansas. So it wasn't actually in dispute in that case whether the facilities of the two schools were equal. The Brown family actually, the legal team for the Brown family actually accepted and stipulated that they were equal in terms of facilities and resources. And then the court actually goes through each school, and the other schools weren't equal at the time, but they, in response to this litigation, they started to build new schools and build new facilities in order to equalize resources. So for instance, I mentioned Prince Edward County. They actually built a new school for the Black students before the Brown decision came down, like about a year before, and a great, nice new school. And the white members of the community were surprised that the litigation continued because they said, well, the Black students wanted a new school. We gave them this great new school. Mm-hmm. We don't understand why they're continuing the litigation. But by that point, it was no longer, you know, a legal battle over equal resources. It was a legal battle challenging the system of segregation itself. So it was a bit too little too late. And when I say it was equal facility, they did build them a new school, but there still weren't equal resources in terms of like books and things like that.
Yes. And so that brings us to here, the legal team behind Brown v. Board, led by Thurgood Marshall, argued that segregated schools were inherently unequal, violating the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. This case challenged the separate but equal doctrine that you were just talking about, established by Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. So there are many interpretations of the law and what Blacks were requesting at the time. And you just stated that part of this, the Blacks were given a new school, but it was the resources that they were lacking. What are some other gray areas when you think about the Brown versus Board of Education? What were the misinterpretations?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there was, so for a lot of the families, a lot of the students who were involved, you know, their primary goal was really to get equal resources, mm-hmm. right? They wanted a new school. They had, you know, and sometimes lobbied for years just to get that. But I think for the NAACP, they had been mounting this legal strategy for years that actually started with law schools and graduate schools. They started there, mm-hmm. challenging segregation of law schools, because oftentimes there would be a law school for whites and there would not be a law school for Blacks. And they would argue that because, you know, law schools, it's about the alumni who you can make connections with, the alumni who are serving as, you know, judges and lawyers, that, you know, it's difficult to provide an equal law school for Blacks when you don't have those similar resources. So they started there with the law schools and the graduate schools, and then started to target the primary and secondary schools. So while you see a lot of the social movements that preceded Brown were primarily lobbying for equal resources, when you get to the legal case, you see it becomes a direct attack on a system of segregation itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people perhaps don't understand, because even for the NAACP, so when the Prince Edward County students, they had been protesting, they staged a walkout because the superintendent, you know, they'd been asking for a new high school, superintendent would not deliver, so they asked the NAACP for help. And then when the NAACP arrived, they essentially told the students that the methods we need to change. Instead of we want a new school, it would really need to be, we're going to petition for desegregation of the school system here. And I think a lot of people don't understand that that was primarily, you know, a strategy, a legal strategy, NAACP, because at that point, they did not think that Black students would be able to get equal resources under a system of segregation. They thought that in order for Black people to get equal resources with white students, they would need to be in the classrooms with white students.
Okay, interesting. So, and that's where you see Chief Justice Earl Warner, he said, he famously wrote, "In a field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place," right? So what's your thoughts?
Yeah, to an extent. Now, I have to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I was actually a quite surprised and a little disappointed when I read Brown v. Board of Education for the first time. And I say because it's a very romanticized case. You know, you think of it as almost like the holy grail of, you know, decisions during this sort of beginning of the civil rights era. So, you know, you hear that, you know, separate is inherently unequal. And so I thought that I was going to be reading a case that essentially said that the system of segregation itself, that allowing Black students to be denied access to a school solely because they're Black is unequal treatment under the law. You know, I thought the case was good. You can't deny someone access solely on account of their race. But that's not really what it says. You know, the crux of that decision is based on what the court describes as a psychological injury to Black children. You know, that Black children feel inferior when they're separated solely because of their race, and that those feelings of inferiority hinders their ability to learn. And so regardless of the quality of the school, you can have two equal schools separately is inherently unequal because it makes Black children feel bad about themselves, essentially, which I did not think, you know, before reading, because I did not think there was just such a heavy focus on the psychology of Black children. I thought that the focus would be primarily on, you know, the unfairness of the system itself. So I was a bit surprised by that.
Yeah, and I don't think Oliver Brown was thinking that either. I think it was mostly resources, right?
Yes, 100%, because a lot of these families, when they started, they really were lobbying for equal. They didn't, like, you know, the Brown family, they didn't have complaints about their school. You know, Linda Brown, you know, like I, or Linda Brown's mother, like I said, she spoke about the great education she received from Monroe. She didn't reference them, you know, psychological injury and having gone to the all Black school. She loved her school. You know, part of the reason the Browns, you know, joined in the litigation was simply on principle. It was not because they thought, you know, necessarily that Georgia had incurred some psychological injury because she was separated. So I think that that was sort of, I think it was a way for the court to not really sort of address, you know, Plessy v. Ferguson, which is the sort of source of that separate but equal doctrine, to not address that head on. A lot of times the court doesn't want to admit to mistakes, right? It wants to sort of say, oh, we have new information now that we didn't have back then that we can now consider. And that's essentially what it says too. It says, we don't know the extent of these psychological tests that were available when Plessy was decided, but now we know them. And so we're taking those into consideration when, you know, sort of overturning this doctrine. Now, I will say this. The NAACP legal team did introduce this, right? They actually had a brief from behavioral scientists that they spoke to introduce this idea of the psychological effect on of segregation of Black children. They did, you know, what is popularly known as the doll test. So they would have Black children sit in front of like a Black doll and a white doll, and they would ask about positive characteristics of the doll versus negative characteristics. And if it was a positive characteristic, the Black child would assign those characteristics to the white doll. And if it was negative, the child would assign it to the Black doll. And so they did introduce this in their brief to the Supreme Court. But that brief, including the attachment from the behavioral scientists, more broadly spoke about the psychological injury, not just to Black children, but also to white children as a result of segregation. And so, I mean, there were two sides of the coin. I think that the NAACP legal team did that because they needed a new argument. They knew that the court would be reluctant to reverse itself on Plessy without some new reason to do so. And that psychological sort of test to show new harm that wasn't really argued during that Plessy era was a way for them to do that. So they did introduce this. You know, hindsight is 2020, you can say, right? So it's easy for me to be kind of critical of it, you know, on the back end. But I do think that the court, you know, regardless of the arguments presented, the court had an opportunity to more directly address the wrongness of the Plessy decision. And, you know, even today, Plessy is, you know, considered one of the worst Supreme Court decisions ever. I mean, you know, up there with Dred Scott. I think it's only second to Dred Scott, right? where we were considered not to be citizens. Yeah. So it's widely considered to be a bad decision. But I don't think that the Brown v. Board of Education decision really attacked it head on enough and attacked the system of segregation and the unequal treatment that derives from that system itself, regardless of the psychological harm that, you know, that you know, may or may not incur on Black children because of that system. I just don't think that they really directly address that issue.
Yeah. And so so with all of that, right? And I mean, you just gave us a ton of new information. Like, I didn't even realize that the Dahl case was attached to this. So there's so much out of this. And I would tell people to really go and just try to read some of this to just learn a little more. But what is some of the positive impacts that you see from Brown versus Board?
Well, I do think, okay, so did Brown v. Board of Education accomplish its ultimate goal of desegregating schools? Unquestionably, no. You know, schools are still very much segregated, primarily due to just residential segregation. But was it effective in dismantling that legal framework that supported segregation? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, after Brown, you saw laws mandating or permitting segregation, they just started to crumble, you know, with buses, restaurants, hotels, segregation. I mean, Brown to me was really sort of the opening salvo in terms of, you know, spearheading this sort of slow decline of this acceptance of segregation in a legal sense. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I do think it was effective in helping to dismantle that legal framework and even fueling the movement to push even further for desegregation beyond public education.
And so now we are here, right, in 2024. And when we think about education now and the education of Black students, what are some of the problems that you still see?
You know, to be honest with you, I think it's the same problem as it's always been. You know, the same problem that, you know, those students in Prince Edward County, you know, walked out of their classrooms in protest against. I feel it's lack of resources.
Yeah.
You know, and I just feel like we don't have that today because, you know, as I said, schools are still very much segregated. You know, Black students more likely to attend schools with other Black students, more likely to attend students that, you know, are that just don't have as much resources as predominantly white schools in wealthier areas. You know, I think that the difference now post-Brown is that instead of, you know, what we call de jure segregation, which is legal segregation, is de facto segregation, which is just segregation by happenstance. Yeah. So, you know, it's difficult to sort of address it when it's something that, you know, isn't legally permissible, but sort of, you know, happened through, you know, arguably individual choices and, you know.
And I would say affordability too, because I go back to where my high school was. And I think during that time, my high school had something called M2M, minority to majority. And it was the kids that were bused to the high school were majority Black kids, but I don't think they could, that area was very expensive. during that time. And so you had people moving in, and then you had people who could not. And so that to try to fix that, they did that minority, the M2M program that didn't last long, but that was their start to try to fix some of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I really, honestly, I don't know how effective those programs, you know, would have been in the long run if they had kept them up. I mean, I do think that we do need to think of more creative ways to try to resolve the issue. But I feel like people in your, I kind of leave that up to people in your field.
You know, and I'm gonna be honest with you, working at schools that, you know, are, you know, the problem is money, okay? With kids who are economically disadvantaged, and we still lack the resources, we still lack the funding to do things and explore and have our kids experience different opportunities. And it's just not so easy for us to raise money like that, or to tap into our PTA funds, because typically there's no PTA. So it's just, that is the problem. And how do we get around that? That is money. If the money was there, a lot of these problems would not be there.
So do you think, well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. And I know we hadn't discussed this before, but I want to get your thoughts. Do you think that the way that schools are funded should change?
Absolutely. I am always an advocate for, so I work for a Title I school, right? And so that means that I want to say maybe it's like 60 or 70% of the kids are economically disadvantaged. So with that comes a lot of other stuff, right? Not only lack of resources, it's really high teacher turnover, and you know, a lot of stress and a lot of things, that extra work that you don't see. And I've had the privilege of working at a school right in Buckhead where these just weren't our issues. So being at both ends, I can see the differences. And I just feel like schools that are labeled Title I or have that economically disadvantaged status, they need support.
Yeah.
They just need support in a whole lot of ways, not even just funding, but with training and just making sure, you know, what makes my job hard is when teachers leave. Because once they're out, you got to hire somebody else and train them again. And if they don't stay, they're, you know, here we go, this revolving door. And that's such a disadvantage, not only for just the school, the students, right? Like there's no consistency there. And so there's a lot of ways that money should be looked at to help support those schools.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting. So I know Seattle, and I only know this because of a recent Supreme Court case. I think it was in 07, Seattle started to do this new system called school choice, where students could actually apply to attend another high school in the district. So it wasn't necessarily based on your on where you live, but you could apply to, you know, whatever high school you went to in a district. I mean, it did come out. So in the Supreme Court case, what Seattle would do, they would have the students apply to the different high schools, and then some high schools, of course, would receive more applications than others. And so they would use a sort of race conscious admission. So they would think about what the student body would look like. And so one of the factors that they considered was race in choosing which of these applicants could go to which school. They wanted the student body to reflect the demographics of the district. Now, the Supreme Court did say that was unconstitutional. They could not consider race even in that inclusive context, but it's still a pretty creative, just the school choice program itself, which means that, you know, where you go to school and the funding of your school isn't necessarily dependent upon you know, where you live exactly, you can go to another high school, a high school that, you know, would likely have more resources. And so I think coming up with creative solutions like that, I think is maybe one of those ways that we could solve that issue of providing students with more equal funding.
Yeah, and then I also look at it as, so what, did they get transportation with this as well? Or
I
they
don't know if they got
buy their own
I'm
transportation?
assuming that they did. I hope so.
Yeah, because I've
but
seen
I don't know if they got
those and sometimes it is your choice, but you better figure out how you're gonna get there. And then, and then that, so you know, you got a parent who's barely making the bills. Okay, forget that. You going back to your homeschool. And then I think those kind of laws also or mandates, they cause more problems for those local schools that are already struggling, because now those kids that actually do leave are, you know, probably the kids that how can I, you know, so the kids that can't
Yeah.
leave, right? They are just, it's such a bad state for them that there's no way for them to get out of that. So how does the school deal with that when everyone is gone? So I don't know. I would like to try to do some more research on what else is out there. I would like to see districts that actually fund their Title I schools more, right? And I think I've seen Fulton County do something like this. Like, they gave teachers an extra bonus or something if they worked at one of their Title I schools versus just a non-Title I school. And I don't know what happened with that, if they're still doing that, but just wanting to see, you know, like you said, different models that are out there to support these schools.
Yeah, where did the extra funding come from?
I don't know. They must have did some stuff with their tax money. But this was before COVID, okay? Now, the extra funding just in the recent years was that COVID funding, but now that's all dried up. All these school districts are back to reality, okay?
No, I mean, it's just such a difficult question. It seems like a question that we have been asking almost since, you know, free education based on general taxpayer dollars came into existence. I mean, how can you provide students with, if not equal resources, then similar resources?
Yeah.
But I mean, it's such a hard question to answer.
Because you also got to look at the other side of that as well, and that's gonna be a whole nother episode. So
okay, I'll be back for that episode too. We're gonna do some research.
We're gonna come back. Episode.
It's the school funding 101. That's the next episode.
Well, this is good conversation for Black History Month. That really concludes our journey through Brown v. Board of Education. And this, we wanted to highlight African American history with attorney Jessica Baker. I have additional resources that you can use on my Teacher Pay Teacher site that explores Black History Month. Please tap into those resources. In addition, I am going to post in the show note the Black History Month resource guide. Use that. We're going to continue to teach Black history well after February, okay? Keep thriving and keep teaching Black history for sure. This program is brought to you by Thrive 12, an educational resource company dedicated to educators around the world. We will be back. Keep thriving. Do your thing. Enjoy.